Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be taking a look at history from the very early days of Louisiana, as well as the backdrop to the current political scene. Our guests are Patrick Maney, author of Bill Clinton, New Gilded Age President, and Aaron Greenwald, author of Marc Antoine Caillot and the Company of the Indies in Louisiana. Patrick Maney is a professor of history at Boston College, where he teaches modern American history with an emphasis on the American presidency and politics. Many of our listeners, however, may remember him from his days at Tulane University. He's the author of The Roosevelt Presence, The Life and Legacy of FDR, and Young Bob, a biography of Robert M. La Follette, Jr. Today, we'll be talking about his new book, sure to be of interest this election year, Bill Clinton, New Gilded Age President. Pat Maney, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, and this is a coming home again, too.
I know. I'm very glad to have you back in New Orleans. So tell us about this new Gilded Age that you talk about in the title of your book.
Well, the original Gilded Age refers to the last, say, quarter of the 19th century, and that term, Gilded Age, was coined by Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner, and what they meant to evoke was a country sort of glittery on the outside, but cheap and tawdry once you scrape beneath the surface. And in the late 80s and early 90s, as Clinton was thinking of running for the presidency and then running for the presidency, a lot of commentators began to see similarities between that period and the original Gilded Age. And I'll tell you what, the similarities were not lost on Bill Clinton, because that was the period, that late 19th century period, that he returned to time and time again. He thought it was the time in American history most like his own, a transformative age. In the late 19th century, the United States sort of morphed from an agrarian nation to an urban industrial giant. You know, in the last part of the 20th century, the United States was moving from an industrial age to a technological information age, and out of the Cold War into a global society. So he returned. That was his touchstone. He thought that period had lessons about how he might deal with the nation's problems.
I was so fascinated when you wrote a good bit about the rise of the presidential historian during this period. And you mentioned, of course, Michael Beschloss and Doris Kearns Goodwin. And I, of course, think of, you know, Stephen Ambrose and his multi-volume biography of Nixon. So what are the rewards and challenges of taking on this kind of history?
Well, actually, a presidential historian is really a media creation. People for ages have been writing, like Stephen Ambrose, have been writing about, and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., have been writing about the presidency. But they would never have referred to themselves as presidential historians, because that's sort of like a court historian whose service is to the royalty or the king and
royal
not
jester.
To the craft. Yeah, and it actually started with McNeil Laird. In the early 90s, they began to feature Michael Beschloss and Doris Kearns Goodwin, and then that phrase just caught on. You know, I mean, in some ways, I'm kind of critical of it, even though now I describe myself as a presidential historian, but it's a cult, I think. And we live in a period, and it really comes to fore during the Clinton presidency, when the presidency sort of becomes sort of a cult attraction for people. And I, in some ways, I think an escape from our real problems.
Well, you know, there is no surer path to fame in some ways than to chase the famous, you know, as a biographer in some ways. Now, you give Clinton a lot of credit, as does everyone, for being the first Democratic candidate to secure the White House since 1976. And one of the things you explore is his use of media Don't you think, too, that in addition to that, he helped create this kind of cult of youthfulness that appeals to us as voters, paving the way for the Obamas a bit, perhaps?
Absolutely. I mean, he was in one of my interests in writing about the Clintons. Clinton was the first baby boomer to occupy the White House, and that was actually one of my interests in writing about him, because I'm a baby boomer, too. We were born within a couple of months of each other, I in the North and he in Arkansas. But he did sort of modernize the presidency. He connected presidency with American culture in a way that no previous president had. The first baby boomer to occupy the White House was bound to have an impact, but one can't imagine some of his other baby boomers of his generation having the same effect. I mean, Newt Gingrich or George W. Bush or Al Gore, you can't imagine them playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall or doing an Elvis impression on Imus in the Morning or telling what their underwear preferences were on MTV. So he did kind of connect, make the presidency sort of more real and understandable and relatable to Americans. And I think that is one of his tangible legacies.
Of course, he had a particular set of skills, as they say.
Absolutely.
You know? Now, one of the things you write about at great length, because it is so important to all of us and the ramifications come down to us to this very day, is all the maneuvering that went on about the economy and the rivalries between different economic agencies. That must have been really demanding to write.
Yeah, I mean, in many regards, I think if you were to ask Clinton, he would say that his greatest legacy was a robust economy during the 1990s. And an awful lot happened, deregulation of banking and telecommunications and the stock market. But I guess in many respects, I think that this is an example of where the new Gilded Age is like the old Gilded Age, that the presidents were really not in control of the economy. Other forces, private forces, business was driving the economy. You know, a couple of people who were greatly admire Clinton, served in the Clinton administration, have told me this. They've said that if the elder Bush had been reelected in 1992, that the economy probably would have performed about the same as it did, and for two reasons. First of all, there wasn't all that much of a difference in economic philosophy between Bill Clinton, who was one of the most conservative Democrats fiscally in the 20th century, and George H.W. Bush. And secondly, the White House was not really where the action was. That wasn't what was driving the economy during the 90s. It was the emergence of the computer industry, telecommunications, and the internet.
I know, it takes you back when you read this book. It's like, all that happened.
It's amazing to me to remember that the internet and personal computer, this is really the 1990s. It seems like, especially for my students, that those things have existed for all time.
Right.
But they really came into use in the 90s.
Now, you also talk a good bit about the defeats of the Clinton administration. And there were several, you know, healthcare, for example. That was a big defeat.
It was, and I think healthcare was misguided in this respect. The Clintons and just about everybody else at the time thought that it should be located, centralized in the White House and then sort of handed down to Congress. But it was a misreading of history, actually, because no major domestic program, Social Security, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, no other major program in the 20th century originated in the White House. All were much more deeply rooted in Congress. So I think in many respects it was doomed from the beginning. But I'll say this, and having said that, I came away with a real kind of admiration and appreciation, which I didn't know before doing deep research on this in the Clinton papers, of Hillary Clinton's role in this. I knew that she was a master of the details and a real policy wonk. What I didn't realize, and this I think has bearing on what her administration might be, what I didn't realize was how politically astute she was and how she assiduously courted Congress for almost a year. I mean, day after day, she would meet with different members of Congress, and not just Democrats, but Republicans as well. And it wasn't Hillary's fault or Ira Magaziner, who was her kind of co-chair in this task force, that Hillary Care wasn't bipartisan. It was the Republicans, including moderate Republicans, who feared the political consequences of kind of getting in bed with the Clintons. But even after they kind of tried to dissociate themselves from Hillary, she kept after them. And so my conclusion is that she would be much more engaged with Congress than President Obama has been, or certainly than Donald Trump would be, or Bernie Sanders.
Sometimes when I imagine their conversations, you know, it strikes me as hilarious because they both are such wonks, you know?
Yeah.
And I love the way you describe his personality as, you know, one, you can't stay mad at him, and two, he never shuts up. He just talks and talks and talks. Yeah. Well, it's important that this book is coming out in an election year, of course. It's good for you,
it's
too, isn't it?
Right.
So what do you think your book offers in this election debate and discovery as we move forward to November?
What I've tried to do most, I think, is to put the Clinton presidency in broad historical perspective, a second Gilded Age, a transformative age. And I think the biggest challenge was not writing from the headlines. I mean, I try to give a sense of how events looked as they were unfolding rather than, you know, looking retrospectively at it as we know what the outcome was. But I think you get a pretty good sense of what a Clinton presidency, or, you know, maybe a Trump presidency would be in terms of the problems that exist, because we are still in a second Gilded Age, a transformative period in our history.
That's right. And I have to say, reading this book was such a pleasure. You are such a wonderful writer. It's clear prose. You have this wry sense of humor that kind of steps up every now and then.
Yeah.
That must have been a struggle to keep out at times. But it's a lot of fun, and it's really interesting.
Yeah,
so
I appreciate that.
We've been talking with Pat Maney, whose new book is Bill Clinton, New Gilded Age President. You can meet him Tuesday, June 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Pat, thank you so much.
And thank you.
Greenwald is one of my favorite people to interview because she takes such joy in her work as an historian with the Historic New Orleans Collection. She really makes history come to life. She was the editor of A Company Man, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies, her first book. And now she's back with Marc-Antoine Caillot and The Company of the Indies in Louisiana, Trade in the French Atlantic World. Erin, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
I think it's safe to say that Marc-Antoine Caillot is one of the most significant men in your life.
He is. You know, I hadn't ever thought of it that way, but it's certainly true.
And all this because of a fortuitous manuscript find. It is the ultimate serendipitous history story, don't you think?
Yeah, that's right. Back in 2004, the Historic New Orleans Collection acquired a manuscript. And they knew that it was from someone who had worked as a clerk for the Company of the Indies, and his last name was Caillot, and they really didn't know anything else. And I was so lucky to have this project land in my lap, looking through the first draft of the translation, and then working on the edited volume that resulted in A Company Man. And that is a book that takes Caillot's memoir and contextualizes it through footnotes, but it's primarily his own words.
And he was a bit of a rogue. He was a bit of a character.
Yeah, he certainly was. I think Larry Powell said it best when he called him a skirt-chasing young man.
And now you've gone beyond his individual experience. I mean, this is the obvious successor. This is the larger surround of his life. This is almost a business biography, isn't it?
It really is. So this is a book that looks very closely at the French Company of the Indies and its predecessors, beginning in the mid-17th century and going through the mid-18th century, through the end of the Seven Years' War, and looking at where Caillot fit within the context of the company, but more importantly, looking at where Louisiana fit within the global context of trade in the 18th century.
And it's a story so much of exploration And wouldn't it be fair to say exploitation as well?
Absolutely. You're dealing at this point in time with the company trying to exploit the resources, both natural and human, that were available here in the Louisiana colony. And also, of course, the widespread exploitation of African laborers who were brought here during the company period as slaves from the west coast of Africa.
And you describe Louisiana as a company colony in which the largest slaveholder was the company itself.
That's right. They owned more than 230 people, making them by far the largest slaveholder in the French colonial period.
And one of the things that you do so well, it's like a bad travel story in some ways, because you describe so perfectly the rigors of travel. First, you have to get to the ship, and that's an ordeal. And
right.
Then being on the ship is an ordeal. And then landing in Louisiana is an ordeal. That must have been fascinating to research and somewhat depressing.
Yeah, I mean, I think many people, when they think about the colonial experience, they think first of the voyage on a ship coming from the coast of Europe across the Atlantic, through the Caribbean perhaps, to the Americas. But Cayo's voyage allows us to really flesh out what travel was like in all of its forms in the 18th century. It took him 3 weeks to get from Paris to the coast, and he's doing that traveling by rented horses. He's going on covered barges down various rivers. He's walking. And then when he gets to the coast, of course, he has to wait while the ship is loaded and readied for Louisiana. He runs out of money before he's even left France. And then, of course, you have the sea voyage. And then when people arrived in Louisiana, they didn't just pull up to what we now know as the French Quarter.
Right.
They had these very large ships that could not pass the mouth of the Mississippi River without running aground on sandbars or mud lumps, getting caught up in a lot of the tree detritus that blocked the mouth of the river. And so most of these large ships would offload all of their passengers, cargo, and enslaved captives at the mouth of the Mississippi River. And then people would be loaded into much smaller vessels and literally rowed up river against the current of the Mississippi River. And that voyage averaged, 8 to 10 days, and most ships arrived in the summer. So it was a very, very difficult voyage at a time when African captives and European travelers were already in a very weakened state from a long period at sea.
And these were big ships.
Right.
I mean, you can tell from your descriptions of them. This was a massive undertaking.
Yes. I mean, some of the ships that came from France had hundreds of passengers on board and anywhere from 20 to 60 crewmen.
And how frustrating to see land, and feel so far away regardless.
Absolutely.
So talk about the company's hopes for what they would find in Louisiana.
So the French Company of the Indies really has several iterations. And the iteration that's the focus of this work really comes on the scene as a result of John Law coming to power in France. John Law comes to power in the 17-teens following the death of Louis XIV, and he creates this financial system, a trading system based on the creation of a national bank that issues paper money, the development of a global trading company that is supposed to stop France from being so reliant on trade with the Dutch and the English, and also the raising of lots of money to support the Company of the Indies through the sale of shares that were premised on the idea that Louisiana was going to be this land of plenty and that it would become a French version of the Chesapeake, meaning it would become this massive tobacco empire. As we know, that didn't happen. We don't associate Louisiana now with widespread tobacco plantations. And the company does attempt to create this plantation empire here, but they fail miserably. And ultimately, they withdraw from Louisiana.
And also they had such high hopes for silver, right?
Right. Well, all of the European powers wish and hope that they will have the luck of the Spanish in colonizing the New World. You know, Spain was fortunate in that they found massive quantities of mineral resources in South America, in Central America. And of course, the French, the English, even the Dutch all hoped to replicate that model.
It seems to me that we're in such glory days for Louisiana colonial history, and it's so fascinating to read about those early days. What is it you think your book adds to the picture we're slowly developing over several books by several people, you know, over these years? Why is this story so important?
Well, you're right. We have been incredibly fortunate in the last 25 years, really since Dan Usner and Gwendolyn Midloe Hall published their monumental works on the history of Louisiana. The historiography has grown just enormously in that time period. My book takes the history of colonial Louisiana and attempts to place Louisiana in a much broader spectrum, in a much broader context that sees it not only as a product of North America or the Caribbean, but really part of a global trading environment that stretched from Pondicherry, India, to Chandernagor, Bengal, to Senegambia, and then, of course, across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, and finally, the lower Mississippi Valley.
And I should say, some of those descriptions of the cargoes from Senegal and from India are fascinating as well. You see how highly desired those things were at that time.
Right. Louisiana is a cog in a much larger machine during this time period.
Now, of the two books, which was more fun to write? The focus on the individual or... You know, this was so much research, you can tell. It's information packed.
Well, the two books do not live separately in terms of research. The research for both books was done simultaneously. Mm-hmm. While I was working on A Company Man, it became very clear that there was a real need in the historiography of Louisiana to further explore this company period. And I thought taking Marc-Antoine Caillot's narrative structure, taking his story as a through line through this history of colonial Louisiana could be a way of making it extremely accessible, not only to scholars, undergrads, but also the general public, because he's an engaging guy.
He is. And he seems kind of bitter at the end when he leaves, you know?
Yeah, he's pretty down on Louisiana by the time he leaves in 1731. But, you know, he gets right back up again. He's on a ship bound for India and greater riches 1 year later.
So what's next for you now?
Well, right now I'm working on an exhibition and an accompanying book called New Orleans, The Founding Era. And the exhibition will be at the Historic New Orleans Collection. It will be our tricentennial celebration exhibition opening in January 2018. And we've got a fantastic group of scholars who are contributing to a multi-author volume that will go along with the show. So that's the focus right now.
And you have a hard deadline, don't you? That's a lot of work. We've been talking with Aaron Greenwald, whose new book is Marc-Antoine Caillot and the Company of the Indies in Louisiana, Trade and the French Atlantic World. You can meet her Thursday, June 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Aaron, thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan.
Sometimes the best beach book is a real chiller of a crime novel. Here are two riveting debuts that made my weekend. Under the Harrow by Flynn Berry takes its title from a C.S. Lewis line in A Grief Observed. Come, what do we gain by evasions? We are all under the harrow and can't escape. We feel that relentless pressure in this novel told in the voice of a young woman named Nora, who's gone up from London to visit her sister in the country town of Marlowe. She looks forward to a pleasant weekend planning a joint trip to Cornwall, but what she finds there, her sister, slain in grisly fashion, will change her life forever. Nora devotes herself to finding Rachel's killer, combing through her shared and separate memories, their lives together and apart. She pressures the police officers, does her own investigating as well, until finally she becomes a suspect herself. The reader zips along. I read this book in one evening, unable to put it down. Events twist and turn at a rapid pace. Barry, who lives in Austin, Texas, is a true Anglophile and brings her setting to life, particularly in her examination of both pub and police culture. And Under the Harrow shows us the human mind and heart as it struggles to come to terms with the one thing that will eventually come to us all, grief. Retired police detective turned indie filmmaker David Swinson makes his debut with The Second Girl, and once you turn the last page, you'll be anxious for a quick sequel. Retired detective turned private investigator Frankie Marr is one of the most memorable protagonists to come along in quite a while. The reader knows he's trouble from the get-go, violent, drug addicted, involved with Leslie Costello, a former police colleague who's now a defense attorney. And yet, you can't tear yourself away from this fast-talking, fast-thinking character fueled by lines of cocaine. When a break-in in search of a stash for his personal use leads to the discovery of a traumatized young girl, he gets her to safety and then finds himself searching for the second girl of the title, another lost daughter of traumatized parents. Marr wins his way through the drug culture underworld of Washington, D.C., sometimes straight, sometimes amped, almost loses his relationship with Leslie, wreaks violence and havoc whenever he feels the need to, then steps inside a men's room to snort a few lines. This book rocks with its completely engaging anti-hero and its non-stop action. Frankie Marr and David Swinson are gunning for you, readers. Watch out. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Patrick Maney, discusses and signs Bill Clinton, new Gilded Age president, Tuesday, June 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Sally Michelle Jackson discusses her new book, The Darkness That Waits, The Housing Cases, Volume 4, Tuesday, June 14th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Esoterotica presents Taste the Rainbow, an evening of readings of original queer erotica, Wednesday, June 15th at 8 at the Always Lounge. Doors open at 7. Today's guest, Aaron Greenwald, discusses and signs Marc-Antoine Caillot and the Company of the Indies in Louisiana, Trade in the French Atlantic World, Thursday, June 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. And June 16th is Bloomsday. Come out and celebrate James Joyce's Ulysses at the Irish House, 1432 St. Charles Avenue, from 6 to 8. Michael Allen Zell emcees readings by Jasmine Araujo, George Bishop, Chris Champagne, Addie Sitchens, Louis Maestros, Chris Waddington, and yours truly. The Sobu Book Club discusses the One Book, One New Orleans book selection, The Baby Dolls of New Orleans, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition by Kim Vosdeville, Thursday, June 16th at 6 at Sobu, 310 Charters. Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop hosts a clue-like mystery evening to celebrate the paperback release of Doing the Devil's Work by Bill Lofelm. That's Thursday, June 16th at 6:30. And the next Maureen Coughlin novel, Let the Devil Out, will be released July 5th. Nordad Adams is the guest host for the Bank Street Open Mic Thursday, June 16th from 6:30 to 9:30 at Bank Street Bar and Grill, 4401 Bank Street. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Ruby by Cynthia Bond Saturday, June 18th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Laura Cayouette discusses and signs The Secret of the Other Mother, a Charlotte Reed mystery, Saturday, June 18th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Alan Gothrow and Daryl Hippensteel sign Dark Bayou, Infamous Louisiana Homicides, Saturday, June 18th from 1 to 3 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Chef Kevin Belton signs his new cookbook, Kevin Belton's Big Flavors of New Orleans, Saturday, June 18th at 3 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. And poet-comic Chris Champagne reads from his work, followed by an open mic Sunday, June 19th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.